I want to tell you about a painting. A painting that is meant to be hanging here in the museum. It is a painting of a flower, believed to be the work of the artist Roman Kramstik. Others suspect it is an early work by the celebrated painter Tamara de Lempicka, arguing that the painting's vibrant colors and geometric shapes are more representative of her Art Deco sensibility than the muted palette and soft contours of Kramstik's post-impressionist style. Since the artists were contemporaries, Varsovian Jews, and both known more for portraiture than representations of flowers, it is difficult for historians to come to an authoritative conclusion on this matter. Alas, the debate will likely never be resolved, for the painting in question has gone missing. Some say the painting was stolen. Some say it was lost in transit, returning to Poland from a private collection in Switzerland. And some say it never existed in the first place. What is known is that it is a painting of a flower, a bouquet of flowers, a bouquet of the fabled Muranov lilies. I want to tell you about this flower and this painting, but since it can no longer be seen in the museum, I would like to take you outside, to the spot where the flower first appeared in Warsaw. We will be outside together for a while, so make sure you are dressed properly. It might be cold out, so you will need to get your coat and scarf. It might be raining, so you'll need your umbrella. Perhaps you are listening to this during the heat of summer, so get your hat and sunglasses. You can put the audio guide on pause until you are ready to continue. I will wait for you. I'll meet you just outside the front doors. People don't agree on the origins of the Muranov lily. Some say it was transplanted to Polish soil from the distant Venetian island of Murano when Józef Szymon Belotti was brought to Warsaw by King Jan Sobieski III to be his royal architect in the 17th century. Its transplantation from Italy to Poland explained the flower's exotic characteristics, unusual beauty, as well as its inability to sustain itself in a new climate. But there's another story that claims the lily first appeared more recently, some 100 years ago, when the Muranov neighborhood had become the center of Jewish life and society in Warsaw. Like many stories that recount the provenance of a flower, like the hyacinth and narcissus, the story of the Muranov lily is a legend, a dramatic tale of love and metamorphosis. And the story takes place right here where you are standing. It is the story of the boy named Zissel. Just left of the monument in front of the main entrance, there is a small park with a grove of trees, walking paths, and wooden benches. Find a spot here. Stand below a tree, wander in the grass, sit on a bench. Find a spot here, and let me take you back 100 years, maybe more, no one is quite sure, to when our story begins. Zissel wanted to be a girl. He spent most of his time with the other girls in Radzymin and enjoyed their ways and games. The boys played with sticks, barrel hoops, and rusty nails. They fought, got dirty, and tore their clothes. But the girls picked flowers in the orchards, sang songs, danced in circles, and their dresses and aprons stayed clean. "Why can't I be a girl?" he asked his parents, Yontov and Manuha. In fact, his parents had wanted a girl. Some say they believed a firstborn daughter would be a good omen for the children to come. Some say Manuha wanted a daughter to name after her dead mother. Some say Yontov had the soul of a woman, that he prayed to the Shekhinah, and in general was oriented towards more feminine things. When Manuha entered her late months, her belly did not become high and pointy, but round and broad, a sign she was carrying a female child. so she prepared a layette of little shirts and jackets festooned with lacework and embroidery, and a pillow with ribbons. Yuntuf put aside the first gulden towards a dowry. But the powers that decide such things saw to it that they had a boy. Since his gowns, jackets, and bonnets had already been prepared, the infant was dressed in them, and when Menuha carried Zissel in the streets, strangers assumed he was a girl. At each stage of his childhood, Zissel resisted being a boy. But time, which is often the implement of destiny, did its work. Despite his preference for girls' things, he inevitably had to do what the other boys of the shtetl did. He was stripped of his dresses and made to put on a gabardine, pants, a ritual garment, and a skullcap like the other boys. He attended cheder and learned what the other boys learned. But Zissel remained a girlish boy. He couldn't stand the brawls and recklessness of the daredevil boys. He wouldn't climb trees, whistle, or chase dogs. The boys mocked him and called him Little Lily Boy. They said it to cause him hurt and shame, but Zissel was convinced that to be a male was unworthy and that the signs of manhood were a disgrace. When no one was home, Zissel put on his mother's dress, her high-heeled shoes, camisole and bonnet, and admired his reflection in the mirror. He had a pale complexion and delicate skin. On Sabbaths, he gazed up to the section of the synagogue where the women sat, and he envied them, all dressed up in their furs and jackets, jewels, colored ribbons, tassels, and frills. He liked their pierced earlobes and tried to pierce his own with a needle. His parents grasped that something was not right about their Zissel. They took to punishing him and calling him a dunce. This only made things worse for him. Make your way counterclockwise around the museum. Walk towards the small mounds of earth with young trees growing at their summit. Wander around them, or climb one if you like, but do not go past them. Time passed. Love blossomed, which changed many things, but not in the way his family had hoped. For while Yuntuf and Menuha were busy arranging a marriage with a shatran, Zissel began to find virtues in his own sex. The rascals of his childhood had grown into respectable youths who discussed religious and philosophical matters, pacing to and fro across the study house in deep deliberation. Of all the youths, Zissel liked best Ezreel Dvoras, who came from Lublin and behaved in big city fashion. He was tall, slim, and dark, with earlocks tucked behind his ears and black eyes with brows that grew together over his nose. An affection grew between them with all the innocent beauty of youthful love. They studied together at yeshiva, sharing their deepest spiritual and intellectual questions, walking down synagogue street arm in arm. At times, Ezreel took Zissel with him to the baker's, where they ate prune rolls for their second breakfast. The two were soon inseparable, and when they were apart, Zissel was steeped in longing. Meanwhile, Zissel found pretexts to dismiss every potential bride paraded in front of him. But because they were two boys, no less than 100 obstacles got in the way of the blossoming of their love. Some say Yuntuf and Menuha grew suspicious of the boys' affection for each other and forced Zissel to marry at once. Some say Zissel took a wife to spite Ezreel after a petty quarrel. Some say the society they lived in prevented Zissel and Ezreel from envisioning a form through which to express their feelings for each other. Some combination of these forces succeeded in separating Ezreel and Zissel. They yielded to the roles tradition had designed for them, and before Rosh Hashanah, both were married. Ezreel to a local beauty in Radzimin, Zissel to the cantor's daughter in Womyanki, on the other side of the Vistula. But they were not happy with these roles. Ezreel and his wife began to quarrel shortly after their wedding, and he moved back home to live with his mother. Zissel was terrified to sleep in the same bed as his wife, and was prone to fits of trembling each time he had to enter the wedding chamber. His parents and in-laws were certain a spell had been cast over the couple. A rabbi was consulted. A witch was consulted. Some say the cures they recommended were identical. One day, Zissel received a letter from Ezreel. His handwriting was elaborate, his Hebrew full of flowery phrases. He described his anguish. He called Zissel my beloved and the desire of my soul. He longed for the old days, when they had studied together, strolled down synagogue street hand in hand, eaten prune rolls at the baker's, and confided to each other the secrets of their hearts. If Zissel would allow it, he would come to Womyanki as swiftly as an arrow shot from a bow. Overjoyed, Zissel answered in a long letter full of words of affection, confessing that his marriage had caused him heartache and shame. Passionate letters were exchanged between the two. Their words often rhymed and were full of insinuations and puns. They quoted passages from the Song of Songs. The fact was, they yearned one for the other with tenderness and great desire. Ezreel began to call Zissel Zissa. Turn to face the museum. Along the pattern of overlapping sheets of glass on the side of the museum, there is a single panel that is transparent. There are no letter forms inscribed on its surface. Do you see it? It is on the bottom right, near the giant garage doors. Walk towards it. Walk all the way to it. Face it. Look right into it as I speak. Finally, they decided to meet at an inn between Womyanki and Radzymin. It was hard for Zissel to find an excuse for leaving, and he therefore devised a trick. In the morning, after his father-in-law had gone to work, his mother-in-law had gone to the dry goods store, and his dainty wife had gone to the butcher, Zissel opened the wardrobe. He put on a pair of women's drawers, a camisole, a dress and shoes with high heels. He draped a shawl over his shoulders and covered his head with a kerchief. He approached the mirror. It was the first time he had donned women's clothing since those secret childhood hours spent in his mother's boudoir. "Why can't I be a girl?" he said to his reflection. "Why can't I be a girl?
Why?"
Some say that it was in this moment that Zissel understood that his ruse to escape unnoticed was in fact an impulse that came from the very depths of his soul. If he was willing to defy his marriage and family to live out his true desire for Ezreel, then why not go all the way? Why not live out all individual truths? Why not defy everything that had ever stood in his way all at once? There are things we are given, and there are things that we choose. And Zissel knew that in this moment, he needed to make a choice that would shape his destiny. Why can't I be? Some say the voice of the universe whispered in her ear, "Don't be a fool. Take from your father-in-law and mother-in-law whatever is handy." Zissa obeyed. She took the dowry from its place of safekeeping, along with her wife's jewelry, and hid them in a handbasket and went outside. When the women in the street saw her, they assumed a strange woman had come to town on a visit. Zissel was no longer. Continue your path counterclockwise around the museum. You'll either have to go to the sidewalk or carefully walk along the driveway to the other side of the lawn, where there are more mounds and big, beautiful trees. Make your way there. Take your time. Zissa hitched a ride to the inn with a peasant cart traveling to Nyeporent. There she got off and asked for Ezreal's room, claiming to be his wife. He was pacing back and forth, as is the way of the impatient. When Zissa entered, Ezreal looked with bewilderment at the young woman who was standing before him. "Who are you?"
You don't know,
she answered.
I am Zissa.
They fell into each other's arms, kissed, and laughed in rapture. They vowed never to part again. They knew they could not return to their homes, so the next morning they hired a wagon to take them to Warsaw. Since they had money and jewelry besides, they quickly rented an apartment in the Muranov neighborhood, bought furniture and everything required to maintain a household. Warsaw is a big city, and no one asked the couple who they were. Thus the pair lived for several years together, indulging themselves to their heart's desire. In Radzymin and Womyanki, the two missing husbands were sought for a time, but since they couldn't be found, it was assumed they had gone off somewhere to the other side of the ocean. Both wives were adjudged deserted. If you walk to the corner of Karmelitska Street, beyond the monument, to the far edge of the lawn, you can see the neighborhood where Zissa and Ezreal lived. The street was called Lubetskiego at that time, and if you look right at the corner, towards Miwa Street, you will see the exact spot where their building once stood. They began a new life. Zissa made friends with matrons and maidens. She amassed a full woman's wardrobe with furs and jackets, colored ribbons, tassels and frills, and quickly mastered a maquillage. Her beard began to sprout, although it was merely a fuzz. She plucked some of it, singed the rest, and from time to time committed the transgression of shaving. In order that the women of Muranov shouldn't become suspicious, Zissa told them she had stopped menstruating early, which was the reason she couldn't become pregnant. But the women of Muranov were not suspicious of their new friend. In fact, she was revered for her special, unusual beauty. They gave her advice on cooking, baking, sewing, darning, and embroidering. They confided their womanly secrets to her. They called her their sweet lily, for her name sounded like Zis, the Yiddish word for sweet, and like Shoshan, the Hebrew word for lily and rose. Storytellers disagree on the conclusion to Zissa's tale. Some say the story ends here, with Zissa living the rest of her life fully integrated into Muranov society, experiencing the same joys and sorrows that life brings every person, growing old with Ezreal and dying a respected and beloved citizen. Some, like Yiddish writer Isaac Basheva Singer, tell of a tragic and unlikely series of events in which Zissa is hired as the attendant at the ritual bath, a testament to her status among the women of Muranov. One night, Zissa is overcome by desire for a woman she is washing, and in their struggle, the two slip, fall, and drown together. There is a third ending, but the raconteuse of this tale has died, and no one remembers how she told it. But all musings on the circumstances of Zissa's death end the same way. It was in the preparation of her corpse for burial that the secret of Zissa's sex was revealed. Ezreal, old and infirm, could not prevent the ritual cleansing of her body from taking place. He could not protect her. A tumult erupted and news spread through Muranov, and some say that when ruffians in a tavern close by heard of Zissa's transgression, they seized whatever weapon they could find and ran to beat Ezreal. It did not take much for Ezreal's frail body to collapse. He too was dead. Ezreal and Zissa were quickly put to rights and buried in a meadow behind the fence late at night, without anyone to follow their hearses or to say Kaddish. Only the gravedigger recited the passages which are said while the corpse is covered with earth. Turn around, back towards the museum, and cross to the other side of the lawn. Walk among the colonnade of trees. In summer they are full of leaves. In winter they are polka-dotted with mistletoe. Take your time as the story continues. In springtime, a cluster of flowers appeared over the mound where Zissa and Ezreal lay. Flowers no one had ever seen in Muranov, or in Warsaw, or anywhere else for that matter. At first the flower looked like any common breed of lily, with all the recognizable characteristics. A tall, slender stalk covered in long, blade-shaped leaves. At the top, large white blossoms, each with six petals, opening outwards to form a horn. The meadow where the lilies appeared had always been fallow, but by the middle of spring, the cluster of lilies had spread, filling the barren area between Gensha and Vowinska streets, miraculously propagating in all directions. It had been an ugly part of the neighborhood, so the residents of Muranov welcomed the sudden garden of lilies. They say it gave off a heady perfume. But when summer came, and the lily appeared to be in full bloom, the stalk continued to grow, spiring through the center and sprouting a new constellation of blossoms that hovered around the rest of the plant. These flowers looked nothing like their white predecessors. They were black, with a decorative, striated pattern on the inside of their petals, which were pointed, forming the shape of a star. Every nose in Muranov agreed. The lily's fragrance was now as sweet as honey. The surprise did not end there. Autumn came, and with it a third tier of blossoms, this time a proliferation of miniature bell-shaped flowers, creating a dense veil over the entire plant. Turn left and continue your counterclockwise path around the museum. You can walk on the lawn or the sidewalk. Rumor of the strange flowers spread, and soon the preeminent Polish-German botanist Eduard Strasburger collected samples to study at the university. He discovered peculiarities beyond those already visible to the uneducated eye. The lily displays a sequential hermaphroditism unlike any flower I have ever seen, wrote Strasburger in his notes on the case. The lily repeatedly switched its sex, expressing sexual differences at different stages of its growth. Its white flowers were male, its black flowers female, and the veil of autumn blossoms displayed a lively burst of pistils, stamens, and sex organs foreign to Strasburger's repertoire. The lily thus covered a multitude of sexual conditions in its growth cycle, with all the equipment to self-pollinate, which he assumed accounted for its rapid spread through the neighborhood. Strasburger named the flower Lilium Muranovese, following Linnaean binomial nomenclature. The following spring, Strasburger assembled botanist colleagues from across Europe to witness the blossoming of his proud new discovery. Flower breeders came from the Netherlands and Turkey in hopes of acquiring bulbs. The snow melted, but nothing broke through the soil where the flowers once stood. Despite the lily's diverse and manifold sexual apparatus, despite robust bulbs and its potential for copious and ecstatic self-pollination, the Muranov lily did not reproduce, and it was never seen again, not in Muranov or anywhere else to this day. It appeared and grew and blossomed and withered in the months after Zissa and Ezreal's deaths, and then never again. Walk towards the side entrance of the museum. Approach it, but do not go downstairs. Stay at street level. Stop in front of the side entrance and turn away from the museum. face the buildings across Anilevicha Street. Some say the flower had been a kind of trick, that it had bloomed and withered with the intention to mock its admirers. It is as though the lily chose of its own volition to not propagate, Strasburger wrote in his notes, in spite of itself, in spite of all of us, in defiance. It was not a very scientific conclusion. Some say the lily that was both and neither, male and female, was surely Zissa's ghost, a kind of dibbuk that had tried to possess the neighborhood. Thus the Muranov lily entered into legend, known only through tales told by those who witnessed its extraordinary and never-to-be-repeated blossoming. It inspired literature and song, and was represented in this one missing painting by Kramstik or de Lempicka or someone else, which seems was the only recorded visual depiction ever made. For Strasburger allegedly destroyed his botanical sketches of the lily in anger. So we are left to weave together an idea of the flower from the few traces of information that we have, a missing painting, a song, and the things some say. Across from you is the spot where the Muranov lilies first appeared, just on the other side of Anilevicha Street. Between house number 7 and 9, there is a passageway. Can you see the path from here? It leads to a courtyard in the middle of 4 apartment buildings with decorative balcony screens. You can cross to the other side of Anilevicha Street at the intersection to your left to reach it. In the middle of a paved area in the courtyard, you will find a small patch of earth. Some say this is where the first lily was seen. Someone has marked the spot by drawing a floral design into the asphalt around the patch of earth. Historians don't agree how or when the design got there. But some say it was traced by a child who saw her own story reflected in Zissa's tale, who understood the importance of remembering and marking such things. And some say, some say.
female, 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 male, female, female, female.
Some.
This is